You to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Back in January of 2001, in his second week in office, President Bush created the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. Other similar offices were set up in other departments, including HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and Health and Human Services. The idea behind the Faith-Based Initiative was to make it easier for religious organizations to participate in federal social service programs. And from the beginning, this idea was very controversial, and criticism came, in fact, from both sides of the political spectrum, from liberals on one side to conservatives on the other. Many people were concerned that this program might violate the principle of separation of church and state, and others asked the question, would some religions be favored over others? And yet other people said, well, how do we know that religious organizations will be any better at providing social services than secular groups? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about the idea of the faith-based initiative and what we can say at this point about how it has worked so far. And our guest for the program is Stephen Monsma from Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's been at Calvin for some time now. He's currently a research fellow at the Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics. Before his time at Calvin, he also taught for a number of years at Pepperdine University and has, in his academic work, spent a lot of time thinking about writing about church and state issues. And one book in particular I just wanted to mention, since it bears on the topic that we're talking about here, is a book that he wrote that was published back in 2004. Titled Putting Faith in Partnerships, Welfare to Work in Four Cities. So we talk here this morning with Stephen Monsma, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, by the way, if it would be a long-distance call for you. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or in fact, someone who might be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can try to keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Monsma, hello.
Yes, it's good to be with you this morning.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. Perhaps the way to start, some people may indeed be familiar with what it is that we're talking about because it has on and off over the time since it came into being, and the president has been talking about it. In fact, it's something that he talked about even before he was elected. Maybe we should talk about the basic concept. What is the basic idea of what is commonly referred to as the faith-based initiative?
The basic idea is that when the government contracts with private entities to provide a variety of social services, that religiously based or faith-based programs should be able to compete on a level playing field with those of a secular nature. In a nutshell, that is really it.
Hmm. And in the past, were they not given that opportunity because of the concerns that it would somehow mean we would be taking government money and putting it into what is essentially a religious enterprise?
In the past, the practices really would vary. I mean, there are some faith-based social service agencies that for years have contracted with the government to provide social services, but there are others who were, you know, ruled off the table at the outset as not qualified to compete for these funds, and there were yet others where it seemed they would apply, but yet they continually would be turned down. So it was very much of a mixed picture, and the faith-based initiative is really attempting to regularize this process, write some rules of the game, under what terms and what conditions can faith-based groups compete for these funds. So it's not so much that it's an entirely new, you know, radical change in public policy, but more a matter of nudging things in a particular direction where the government would be more open and friendly to faith-based groups to take part in receiving funds to provide social services of a variety of types.
Hmm. Well, if you look back to that period before this faith-based initiative came along, and you took a look at those religious organizations that applied for and got federal funds, and then those that didn't, what exactly was the difference? And was it so much a matter of the difference between the organizations, or maybe did it have something to do with whoever happened to be reviewing the proposal?
To a large degree, it was the latter case. It seems to be much of a hit-and-miss type situation, although if there's any pattern at all, it was the larger faith-based social service agencies that would seem to qualify and receive funding. And it was more the smaller faith-based groups, the newer ones, that had trouble, probably in part because of their faith-based nature, but also in part just in difficulties in navigating the government, funding process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president, as I mentioned, very, very early in his first term, in January of 2001, announced the establishment of this office, the White House office, and then similar sorts of centers based in five cabinet agencies: education, health and human services, housing and urban development, justice, and labor.
Yes.
And then it wasn't until that summer, in July of that year, that the House passed its version of this. The Senate also took up the issue. That stalled, and eventually what happened was, because it wasn't going anyplace in the Senate, and this again took a little while longer. This wasn't until the fall of 2002, the next year. The White House apparently got tired of this not going anywhere, and there was an executive order implementing mm-hmm. this. What in the Congress, particularly I guess in the Senate, was the hang-up on this?
Well, the key issue that emerged and helped to derail the process in the Senate was the whole issue of whether faith-based groups that receive government funding, whether or not they would be able to make hiring decisions, that is, hiring of staff based on the religious views and the religious values of the persons whom they were hiring. And many faith-based groups feel that this is an important right that they need to maintain. There's no doubt that they can, make hiring decisions based on religion if they do not receive government funding. The only issue is, because that's explicitly was provided them in Section 702 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But the question comes, if they receive government funding for a particular program, do they lose this this hiring right that they had been given in the civil rights legislation of 64? And there were some who felt very strongly that if faith-based groups receive government funding, that it should be required to hire anyone regardless of their religious views. Others have felt equally strongly that faith-based groups that receive government funding have a right to continue to make hiring decisions based on religion. And this has been a particularly bitter bone of contention in Congress and has made it difficult to make any real progress on the legislative front.
Hmm. So indeed that still to this date hasn't really happened in the Congress?
Right. It still is. I mean, right now, it's a huge issue in Congress when it comes to reauthorization of the Head Start Act and the reauthorization of what's called WIA, or the Workforce Investment Act. It's a jobs training program. And these are both programs, of course, that have been in existence. But there's, as it's being reauthorized, there are those who feel we need explicit provision that faith-based groups that would take part in these programs should continue to be able to make hiring decisions based on religion. And there are others who feel equally strongly in the opposite direction. So this is continues to be a key issue that's being debated in Washington.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably worth underscoring the point, or making the point, that while there is this discussion about whether or not religious groups should be able to, in effect, discriminate in hiring, that is, hire the people that they want with the kind of religious background that they want, mm-hmm. it is still, at least as far as I know, it's still the case. An important feature is that for those organizations that receive these federal contracts, they cannot discriminate in their clients. They
right.
can't require the people
right.
that they serve to have a particular kind of religious faith, or any religious faith at all, I guess, for that matter.
Right. They would not. They would have to serve anyone who comes. Cannot say we serve only Presbyterians or only Catholics or whatever. And they cannot discriminate in their hiring when it comes to things such as gender and race, et cetera. All of those provisions of the civil rights laws apply in this general agreement that that should be the case. The only area where there is disagreement, although admittedly it's a very important area, is that of the hiring of paid staff by faith-based groups that receive government funding.
Well, let me again very quickly introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Professor Stephen Monsma. He's a research fellow at the Paul Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics at Calvin College, which is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he's been on the faculty of Calvin for quite a number of years. He is someone who has specialized in his academic work in the relationship between church and state. And we're talking here this morning about the faith-based initiatives, what we know about them, how much money has gone into them, how well they have worked. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that for a long time, at least as recently as the fall of 2003, so maybe a year, as recently as a year and a half ago, there were a lot of open questions about the faith-based initiative. And in fact, it seemed to be difficult to answer questions like, well, how many organizations have applied for funding, and how many of them have got funding, and how much money did those groups get? Are those questions now that we have some answers to?
Well, there still are a lot of questions out there along those lines, because you know, we need to be very clear that the faith-based initiative is not about creating a separate pool of money and say, okay, this money has been earmarked for faith-based organizations and it's going to go only to them. Rather, it's about creating a level playing field in the sense that faith-based groups can compete on an equal basis with secular groups for federal funding that is already out there. And, of course, a lot of that funding goes through the states. It's in the form of block grants of one type or another. So to really get a handle on how much is going to faith-based groups, is more going to faith-based groups now than in the past, how much went in the past, et cetera, you need almost to go state by state. You also have to define faith-based groups. And, you know, there are some that would disagree on exactly what is a faith-based group. There are some that, you know, were founded with a religious base and a religious mission, but that have largely secularized. Should they be considered faith-based? And in fact, some states haven't even kept track of, you know, when they issue contracts or grants, which ones are going to faith-based groups and which ones are going to non-faith-based groups. So, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty out there, and we're getting some additional data now, but it still is, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainties out there.
Mm. Well, I know that the White House has, in fact, put some numbers out there. Do you think that they are, do you think that they're something that are solid enough to say, well, at least the White House says this much money has gone out and it's gone to this many groups? And so,
yeah, so those are some of the, you know, the figures that they are putting out. As far as I know, they are basically accurate, but they also apply only to some programs. The best data they have are for federal programs where the federal government itself is directly funding faith-based and other nonprofit or organizations. But the bulk of the money that is presumably going to faith-based groups is funneled through states, rather than funded by the federal government directly. And that's where it's much more difficult to come up with statistics that we can really be confident of.
Hmm. Can you even at least say something about, if you take a look at the total amount of money, something about the ratio of religious groups to secular groups, and what percentage now of the organizations that receive the kind of money that we're talking about are, in fact, clearly faith-based groups.
Well, the area that I know the most about, because I've done my own research in this area, deals with welfare-to-work programs, and particularly those in several large cities. I conducted a major study of the welfare-to-work programs in Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Dallas. And there, you know, the vast majority of funds were going to non-faith-based groups. The faith-based groups were going on memory now. I think it was something roughly 10% or so of funding was going to faith-based groups. So, yeah, they were in there. They're providing welfare-to-work services, but the majority of funds were either going to a variety of government agencies, secular nonprofits, and in some cities, for-profit companies.
Well, here I'm prompted to ask another question that, again, is maybe one of those that's difficult to answer. But you were talking earlier about the idea that part of the idea behind the faith-based initiative was to, in a sense, level the playing field so that religious groups had the same sort of opportunities to apply for federal funds to do social service work as secular groups. When this was first proposed, I think that there were some people who laid out the concern that that in fact the playing field, when you take a look at the religious groups that were applying for and receiving money, that they're the playing field among them might not be equal, and that some groups would be some faiths, for example, might be favored over others, or within a particular faith, say within Christianity, that maybe some kind of groups would be favored more than others. Is it possible, again, to take a look at those groups that have received money and say anything about who it is that got the money and how that breaks down according to faith and to sect within faith?
Boy, again, those are hard questions to answer. The main pattern, if you go back several years, the main pattern would be that most of the government funding that would go to faith-based groups went to the larger, more institutionalized groups such as Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, Salvation Army, you know, those organizations that are well known, to almost everyone. But it gets more difficult when you start talking about smaller faith-based groups, some of these storefront efforts and so forth, that drug rehabilitation, reentry of persons who have been convicted of a crime, reentry from incarceration, et cetera. It gets more difficult. The evidence is that many of them do not receive government funding, but many as well do. For example, in my study of welfare-to-work programs in those four large metropolitan areas, of the faith-based welfare-to-work programs, roughly half of them reported receiving no government funding. Because you turn it around, half were receiving government funding, whereas of the nonprofit secular groups, the larger nonprofits, only 4% reported receiving no government funding. So, you know, from that you can see that the faith-based groups, many of them were receiving government funding, but the secular welfare-to-work programs, a much higher percentage of them were receiving government funding.
If you ask this question again, going back to this question of why it is that among religious groups that some would manage to get funding and others not, and you look at the fact that maybe those that are receiving a lot of the funds are large, well-established organizations, does that have something to do with the fact that a group like that, having been in business for a long time, understands the process? They know where the money is. They know how to get it. They know how to write grants. They know how to jump through all of the hoops that the government makes you jump through before you can get the money, something that would probably be much more challenging and difficult to a smaller organization that doesn't have that experience, that maybe doesn't have a lot of staff, that would find the process of simply applying to be very difficult.
Yes, I think that's a major factor. I mean, they know how to, so to speak, how to work the system. They know how to apply for grants, and often we'll have full-time persons on the staff that, you know, are working at this. And over a period of years, they've established relationships with the, you know, the funding agencies of government, so that there's a relationship there. But I don't think that's the whole story. You also find in many of the smaller faith-based groups, there's a certain suspicion of government, where they're fearful that if they do accept government funding, that perhaps certain limits will be put on their religious mission as they would like to carry it out. So there's that factor. But after that, I do think there's evidence that another factor would be a certain amount of prejudice against faith-based groups. I think you could put it that way. I know in, again, going back to that four-city study of welfare-to-work programs, if you compared the smaller secular, what are often called community-based programs, there were roughly 30% of those that received no government funding, but that compares to 50% for the faith-based groups. They were equally small, equally sort of non-professionalized, but yet the community-based groups were more successful at getting government money, the secular community-based groups, than were the faith-based groups. So, you know, there's a, as is often the case in the real world, there's a variety of factors going at play in play here. It's too simple to say, well, the government's discriminating against faith-based groups. It's all due to there being an unlevel playing field. But I do think that is a factor helping to explain some of these disparities in government funding.
Another one of the questions that had been raised early on about the faith-based initiative, and perhaps I'm sure is still being raised, is the issue of the quality of the kind of programs that are offered. And in particular, if, again, we're trying to draw some sort of stark comparisons between secular organizations and religious or faith-based organizations, and ask this question, say, if we have, as much as possible, if we have two organizations or two sets of organizations that are trying roughly to do the same sort of thing, then we have to ask the question, well, do we have any reason to believe that the religious organizations would be any better at providing that service or providing that function than the secular organization?
That's a very good question, and there have sometimes been rather, strong claims made by supporters of the faith-based initiative that faith-based groups do it much better. They're much more effective, and I've heard stories of a faith-based organization that would have a success rate, in the 70-80%, whereas government programs in the past have struggled, to get a success rate of 10-15%. But even though I myself am a supporter of the faith-based initiative, I do feel you start looking at some of these different programs, and I come away with a very clear impression that these sort of claims, exaggerated claims of faith-based effectiveness tend to be exactly that, exaggerated. That when you really control for the relevant variables, where you look at, for in terms of the types of clients that the programs have, the kind of activities they're engaging in, that faith-based groups will sometimes do somewhat better, sometimes about the same, occasionally somewhat worse. They're right in there. It's not that they're totally incompetent, unable to provide effective services, but neither does it seem to be the case that they are brilliantly more successful than secular private groups or even government run programs. So I feel if you want to make a case for the faith-based initiative, as I do, it really has to be made more on the basis of fair play or equity rather than on the basis that faith-based groups are always going to be that much more effective or successful than their secular counterparts.
We talked a little earlier about the fact that some of the argument and discussion about how this should be shaped and what sort of restrictions we're going to place on the organizations, the religious organizations receiving these funds. And we talked about the fact that while religious groups may discriminate in their hiring, that is, if you're a Protestant organization and you decide you want to hire people who are Protestants, well, you can do that. But you cannot require all your clients, the people that you're serving, to be Protestants.
Right.
Also, there was, in an effort to get at or to address the issue of the church-state sort of issues, the idea was that religious groups were not supposed to use this money, the government money, to do what things that are clearly religious activity, inherently religious activity. On the other hand, we said to them, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to completely give up your religious identity and pretend that you're a secular organization and that in people who are going to sit on your boards. And, you know, that doesn't mean that if you're a Christian organization that you have to go around and you take down the crosses off the wall. We're not going to tell you that you have to do anything like that. But it just seems to me, though, that that's a fairly difficult line to walk between maintaining your identity as a religious organization and not doing anything that is in a sense that can be in any way viewed as a proselytizing.
Yes. Again, this is an area where there are issues and where there's a certain amount of uncertainty. Because I think all of us believe in the separation of church and state. I certainly do. And I'm abhorred at the thought that there would be any kind of coercion where anyone would be forced to engage in religious worship or be subjected to efforts at proselytization that that person does not want to be subjected to. But there are several ways to work at this, I think, where we can have government funding of faith-based groups and not violate this basic norm of church-state separation and non-religious coercion. One is, and I think the most effective way, the simplest way, would to make sure that the recipients of these services, the clients, have complete freedom of choice, that they can choose a faith-based group, if indeed that's what they want, if that's what they prefer, they have that option. But if they'd rather not be receiving these services from a faith-based group, that there are secular alternatives that they could choose. So it's purely a matter of individual choice. You can go to a faith-based group, and then if there are some prayers or there's some crosses or Stars of David or so on the wall, well, hey, that was your choice. If you don't like it, you can walk out the door and go down a couple of blocks down the street and go to a secular organization where you will not be subjected to that. So that is one approach, that the faith-based initiative and what's been called charitable choice legislative provisions has insisted on, that persons be given secular alternatives if they do not want to receive services at a faith-based group. The other approach that it is being used gets a little trickier. I mean, I think the language that has been used, that, federal financial assistance may not support, I think I have the wording right, inherently religious activities such as worship, religious instruction, or proselytization. Hmm. But of course, that is subject to interpretation then. Let me go back. I've attended and interviewed many persons at welfare-to-work programs. And in many of those programs, they're working with clients who may have been victims of domestic violence and abuse, whose lives, they've had trouble getting their lives put together from, most of us would say they've experienced one failure after another. And so these groups would often, and the faith-based groups that I attended, would assure these women, they usually were women, that, look, God loves you. He has a plan for your life, and that work is important, and it's a way to give thanks to God. And that's is this religious worship? Is this sectarian instruction? Is this proselytization? I mean, that's a long ways from, urging the people to join you know, Emmanuel Baptist Church or something. You know, that clearly would be proselytizing. So there's some lines of distinction that I think need to be made, and they're in the process of being drawn. It will have to be a sort of trial and error where the courts and the government will say, this is okay, this is not okay. There's a number of lawsuits that are in the courts now. I suspect some they will say, look, this goes too far in terms of integrating religion into what the services that are being offered. No, this is okay. This is permissible. And it's going to take a while to sort out some of those issues.
We have a couple of callers to talk with, and we will do that in just a moment. I want to take the opportunity to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Stephen Monsma. He is a research fellow at the Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics at Calvin College. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he has been at Calvin for a long time. Before that, he also was on the faculty at Pepperdine University and has written on, in various ways, on church-state issues. And one book in particular that I do want to mention, because it has to do with this subject we're talking here about this morning, if you're interested in doing some reading, is titled Putting Faith in Partnerships, Welfare to Work in Four Cities. This book came out in 2004 and is published by the University of Michigan Press. So if you're interested, you can certainly seek that book out. And here on the program, as always, we have the opportunity for you to ask questions, make comments. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and call us in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455 is the number. Also, we do have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do have callers here, and we'll start. Talk here first with someone in Kankakee on our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Is not charity better left with the church and not with the government? And is not the engagement of government in charity, even when government contracts with the church to do charity, divert resources from society in the form of taxation, which resources, if left in the hands of the people, could more effectively and efficiently be applied to charity, and also applied to charity without confusion of purpose and ethical compromise? Thank you.
Well, have you had some thoughts on, obviously the caller poses several questions. Thoughts on any of that?
Well, I think that an important starting point is to understand that the government engages by way of contracts in a lot of social service programs across the board, and that most of these, at least many of these, are not provided by government agencies themselves. You know, like even you know, in whether it's Head Start, drug rehabilitation, reentry of those who've been incarcerated into society, welfare to work, as I've talked about it, et cetera, that most of these social services already are provided by government by way of contracts that the state or federal government enters into with private entities, or sometimes even local government entities, such as a community college. And the real issue, really, when we talk about the faith-based initiative, isn't so much, well, how much money should be going into this? Should these be provided by, you know, what should be the level of funding, et cetera? The question is, you know, at the level of funding that we have now, if we have these programs, should faith-based groups be allowed to participate in them along with their secular counterparts? That is really the public policy question that the faith-based initiative is attempting to address.
All right. Let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, we haven't heard any discussion of the fact that two heads of at least the White House-based faith-based initiative sort of left with very cogent critiques, some more vocal than others. It seems to me that there's just no way that evangelism can be not done in subtle or unsubtle ways with faith-based initiatives. The way that this was introduced through executive action and the way that it's not investigatable and we don't have good figures on it leaves a lot of room for speculation that there is certainly, it's plausible that electoral motives such as very specifically inroads into black republicanism through the religious community, which is where it, surprisingly enough, is in this community and many others is situated. On a just maybe a gross political question to you, your majority of your colleagues at Calvin College signed and published an open letter on the occasion of the visit of the president to Grand Rapids not so long ago. I'm wondering whether you found it useful to sign that or whether you are holding back have a critique of the same. And I have actually have to go to an appointment, so I will listen on the air.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Well, I can answer the specific question you raised. As some of your listeners may know, President Bush addressed our graduation ceremonies here a few weeks ago. And actually, it wasn't a majority of the faculty. It was about, I think, a third or less of the faculty signed a letter where they, you know, they said, we welcome President Bush to campus, but question many of his policies. I did not sign that letter. Although I consider myself a Democrat and did not vote for, I voted for John Kerry in the last election, although I support President Bush and his faith-based initiative very much, but I felt that we should welcome him to campus if this was a non-political, non-partisan event. But maybe I could also address the caller's question about the politics of this. You know, on both sides of the question, you know, issues have been raised. Well, is this being played, you know, are politics being played here? On the one hand, it's argued that President Bush is pushing this faith-based initiative, as your caller suggested, as perhaps to make inroads into the African-American community to get federal money into some predominantly African-American churches to support their social service programs. So this will help him and other Republicans politically. On the other side of the coin, it's been claimed that many Democrats are opposing the faith-based initiative simply because President Bush is pushing it and has made it one of the you know, key aspects of his domestic agenda, and just want, are using this to embarrass and to thwart a major policy initiative of the president. Those who support this position will point to the fact that during the Clinton administration, in four different pieces of legislation, wasn't called the faith-based initiative at that point. It's really called charitable choice. But there were provisions very similar to the faith-based initiative in four separate pieces of legislation, all of which President Clinton signed and which went through Congress relatively without a great deal of controversy. So you can make that kind of partisan argument back and forth. I guess I would rather look at the public, at the substance of the public policy, and either support one side or the other side, and not try to determine my own position based on certain perceptions of partisan politics that are being played. I suspect there's a certain amount of partisan politics being played on both sides of this issue, but as more of an academic, I would rather look at the public policy issues and consequences and determine my position on that basis.
As the caller mentioned, I believe this is true, you correct me if I'm wrong, during the time that the White House Office on Faith-Based Initiatives has existed, it has had three heads. The man who was the first, John DiIulio, in fact, wrote the foreword for your book that right. We mentioned, has, to the extent that you can answer this question, has that been a difficult job to have?
Actually, there's been only two heads of the White House office. There's John DiIulio and then Jim Toohey, who's at the head of the office right now. Now, there was a David Kuo, who was, I think, the second in command or so. It was one of the top persons who left the office. And after leaving it, I forget the exact story, had raised some questions or had some negative comments to make. And your caller probably was thinking of that person.
Yeah, I guess I was too.
There were only two persons who have actually headed the office. And hey, as Washington goes, that's pretty good record of stability. Now John DeJulio did leave after, I think it was about 6 months, seven mm-hmm. months, and I know John fairly well. He tells me that when he initially took the position, that he really agreed to do it only for 6 months to get the office off the ground, and he never actually, you know, moved to Washington, D.C. He lives in Philadelphia, and he was commuting down to Washington, and this is proving to be rather hard on his family and his health and so forth. So that's why he left. And since then, Jim Turi has been ahead of the office ever since.
Mm-hmm. I guess I do recall, and maybe this wasn't so much an issue, that Mr. DeJulio saying some things about once he got there and saw the way that Washington worked and what life was like and what a difficult sort of bare-knuckles business it was, that he decided maybe that really wasn't what he wanted to do.
Well, there may have been some of that. You know, Harry Truman once said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. Man's best friend, that's probably the only friend you have. So that there may have been some of that. And I know also with John DeJulio that he had hoped to take a bit more of a conciliatory approach, negotiate, find common ground, work it out, and especially some of the Republicans in the House during the first Bush term. We're a little more willing to kind of stick it to the Democrats. We're not as quick to compromise and try to negotiate out and find the common ground as what John DeJulio had in mind. So that may have been a factor as well.
Mm. We're coming to the point here where we have about 10 minutes left, maybe just a little bit less in this part of Focus 580. And again, I'd like to introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Stephen Monsma. He's a research fellow at the Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics at Calvin College. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and has been associated with Calvin for quite a few years. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go to Crystal Lake for another caller here on line number four. Yes?
Does it seem like putting the foot in the door to get rid of separation of church and state? State funds, government funds would be going to these distribution of taxpayer funds agencies, and also it could favor one religious group over another by helping to build their infrastructure, like buildings and such things. Does that seem possible?
I do not see this as sort of a foot in the door type situation or the camel's nose under the tent, for the main reason that there has been funding of faith-based groups for some time in the United States, like religiously based colleges and universities have received funding for years. You can go back to the 19th century even, and there are precedents for government funding of various charities, including faith-based charities. So I do not see this as something that's wholly new and a totally new public policy departure. Rather, it's more a matter of trying to regularize and expand to some degree a previously existing process. So on that basis, I really do not have the fears in regard to losing our basic principle of church-state separation. And I could also add, I've also done some study of what other countries, other Western democracies, such as England and Germany and the Netherlands, are doing in this area. And they actually do more funding of faith-based groups than what we do in the United States. It's almost their policy of, rather than government providing social services directly, of working through agencies, secular and faith-based both, in order to provide services. So I think even if you look at other democracies, you see that this is not some radical path that President Bush has attempted to depart on, which is going to lead us away from religious freedom or church-state separation. And, the question
the second question I believe the caller had dealt with, are we going to be helping one type of religion over another? Will, you know, will we come back, you know, in a few years and find out that all the money is going to Baptists or all to Catholics or all to Christian groups and none to Muslim or Jewish groups? Well, I think the answer to that is, I mean, on one hand, it's vigilance. Vigilance. Certainly no one, I think, would want this to happen. And in order to prevent it, the key criterion in dispersing these funds really should be the effectiveness of the programs. I think we should be funding effective programs, whether they're secular, Baptist, Muslim, Jewish, Presbyterian, whatever. As long as we use the criterion of program effectiveness, rather than looking at, well, what religious group is this from and trying to favor one over another, I don't think we will find ourselves caught in that trap of favoring one type of religious perspective over another.
Hmm. Just we're coming down to the point here where we're very tight on time, and I guess I would like to give you an opportunity just for at least a couple of minutes here to talk a little bit about the research that you did looking at faith-based organizations that were doing welfare-to-work programs, and that's what the book Putting Faith in Partnerships does. You studied, gather several hundred programs like this in Chicago, Dallas, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. Do you come up with any sort of basic conclusions, particularly about the effectiveness of these kinds of programs?
Well, on the effectiveness issue, we did further research in regard to the Los Angeles programs, and that's going to be coming out in a book that Georgetown University Press is publishing. The manuscript is done, but it's in the production process. It'll probably be next year sometime before the book is actually out. But there we found that the for-profit programs seem to be the most effective, more effective than either the government programs, the secular nonprofit programs, or the faith-based nonprofit programs, in actually moving persons into employment and off from welfare. Where the faith-based groups tended to prove highly effective in that study was in things such as creating what social scientists call social capital, where the persons who took part in faith-based groups, even a year later, many of them were reporting that they had frequent contacts with staff members from their welfare-to-work program, or where they had continuing contacts with other fellow participants in those programs. And their sense of optimism or hope for the future tended to increase. So, you know, you look at that, it's not unidimensional. The faith-based groups seemed to excel in some areas and did not excel in others. The for-profit groups excelled in some areas and less so in other areas. And this so often happens in social science research that it's not where, where there's a clear pattern in all dimensions that one type of organization or another is clearly superior. You tend to get a mixed pattern, and that's what we found in this study as well.
Well, given the fact that if you, to the extent that we can now, if you take a look at those organizations that have received money now since the faith-based initiatives programs got going, given the fact that many of them, if not most of them, are big, well-established social service providers, groups that have been receiving federal money in the past and maybe for a long time. You look at analysis that was done recently by the Associated Press going out and looking at who was getting the money. And one of the things that they found was, in fact, that some of these organizations didn't even think of themselves as being faith-based. You know, given in things like that, you have to ask the question, well, did the coming of the idea of the faith-based initiative really change anything? Or did it change things very much? How dramatic a development is this?
Yeah. Well, it did change things, but not 180 degrees.
as is often the case with public policy in the United States, we tend to make public policy by what is called increments, incremental change, rather than radical change, which is probably good. You avoid huge mistakes when you engage in incremental policy making. And what happened with the faith-based initiative, President Bush really took a concept that was out there, was being practiced in many states, less so in other states, a concept that under the Clinton administration had been incorporated into four different pieces of legislation, and highlighted it and pushed it, and in the process has, you know, pushed public policy further down the field in that regard. He's pushed the ball further down the field and further than what it would have gone without this faith-based initiative. But that's quite different than saying this is some radical new public policy departure. You know, it came totally out of left field or right field, maybe I should say. But that is not to say that this is insignificant. I think this is a significant departure. It's making changes, and ones that personally I tend to applaud.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest for this hour, Stephen Monsma. He is research fellow at the Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. His book, by the way, if you'd like to look at it, is titled Putting Faith in Partnerships, Welfare to Work in Four Cities, published by the University of Michigan Press. And Professor Monsma, thanks very much.
It was good being with you.
The broadcast today made possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Thanks to the friends of WILL, we have raised more than $760,000 in support of WILL radio this year. However, we are still $90,000 short of the money that we'll need to purchase and broadcast programs when our new fiscal year begins July 1st. Your contribution before June 30th can help us soften the impact of continuing reductions in federal, state, and university funding. If you use your credit card, your contribution will be definitely in the bank by June 30th, please call us at 217-244-9455 right now or contribute online at will.uiuc.edu. And thanks. We're going to take a break here as we usually do. In the next part of Focus, we'll be talking about the American Revolution. Our guest will be historian Stanley Weintraub. We'll talk about his new book, Iron Tears, that tries to take a look at the revolution from the British perspective. First, though, we'll have news and update on the markets, so stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
On the Chicago Board of Trade, the July wheat contracts firmed up at 3.60.